Broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University, this is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM. It's time now for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
It was another change election in Salisbury this week. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Well, Mayor Jim Ireton handily won re-election, along with incumbent Councilmember Shaney Shields. A key member of the current council majority went down to defeat. Urban planner Jake Day swept into office with 71% of the vote to defeat two-term council vice president Debbie Campbell. Ireton has found many of his initiatives blocked by Campbell, Council President Terry Cohen, and Councilmember Tim Spees. Ironically, at one time, Ireton and Campbell were allies, but no more, with Ireton actively supporting Jake Day. The council majority and the mayor have tangled over issues such as redevelopment deal for the bricks, as well as Ireton's proposal to tighten up on rentals in the city. The other key figure in this picture, of course, is Joe Albaro, who lost to Ireton, 68% to 31%. His blog has played a major atmospheric role in the city politics and at one time supported Ireton. In short, the movement that rose up against former Mayor Barry Tillman years ago seems to have fractured and now lost its majority in the council. And no one knows the old council majority better than local blogger G.A. Harrison, who supported both Albaro and Campbell. Also on hand is Salisbury University professor Michael Laughlin, who was a supporter of the former mayor, Barry Tillman. Welcome to the program. I want to turn to you, G.A., and just get your overall sense. First of all, what was your reaction to the results? Any surprise there? And what do you think happened?
Well, my biggest surprise was turnout. Given the amount of money that was expended in this campaign, given the amount of effort that was put in by various candidates, you would have thought that turnout would have gone up. And yet, compared to 4 years ago, turnout dropped by almost 20%. And, I mean, quite frankly, I mean, that was my biggest surprise. Am I shocked that Joe and or Debbie lost? No. Elections are elections. I was quite frankly surprised by the margin. And what that tells me is that, between apathy of the voter and various issues, you have to look at the two races separately, particularly when you're looking at Albaro and Campbell. It's just quite obvious that Jim Ireton and Jake Day, who ran a joint phone bank operation on election day and leading up to it, were able to whip their voters to the polls, and the other candidates weren't, and they're to be congratulated for that. It was a hard-fought race. They won, and they won by a decisive margin.
Michael Laughlin, how did you read the results?
Well, I share the Mr. Harrison's observation with regard to the turnout. I mean, I think this continues to be a problem for the politics of Salisbury, that the turnout continues to be low, and particularly relative to the potential electorate. And so in that respect, I think we should be troubled and disappointed that more people did not come to the polls, because elections are supposed to represent the expression of democratic politics and the people's voice. And I think that was muddled. It's not really clear what is being expressed. On the other hand, I would say that one message came through, seems to me that Councilwoman Campbell and certainly Mr. Albaro really represented a politics of negativism. Mr. Albaro's blog, I think, it was notorious in terms of its personal attacks on politicians in office and out of office. And Councilwoman Campbell came to be known as someone who was more involved with power plays rather than with really public policy. And so I think that the vote to reelect Jim Ireton, on the one hand, an incumbent, and the vote to elect a fresh, new, unknown face, Jake Day, represented an effort to say, no, we don't want a mayor that is going to be a negative, and we don't want a councilwoman who who seems to have evolved into this negative politician. So there's a real new opportunity here, I think, for a new majority to go forward, and with a mayor that has some ideas, and perhaps we can move to transcend personal politics to debates about public policy and where the city should go forward.
Gee, what about the idea that voters and often were, certainly in terms of Campbell, were responding to the sort of this negative atmosphere? Because I know, when I talked to Joe Albaro after the election on election night, one of the things he indicated that as he looked at the vote, that was one of the things he thought may have played a role in this. What about that?
Well, like I said, and as I stated earlier,
sure.
It's very important that you particularly when you're talking about Campbell and Albaro, that you separate the two, because they different issues. I fully accept. I mean, it's that you know, SBY News had an impact, probably a negative impact on Joe's candidacy. But what Professor Laughlin says about Ms. Campbell, I agree with some of it to the extent that's the perception, but you need to look at why that perception is. You know, Professor Lawson said, well, you know, the message is we don't want 4 years, we don't want any more negativism. Well, under Jim Ireton, who I supported 4 years ago, we've had 4 years of political theater. I mean, I have never in my life seen, you know, except perhaps in large cities, I have never in my life seen an elected official stand up on a soapbox and call other elected officials racists. And yet that's precisely what Jim Ireton did in June of 2011. And that's just one of the more egregious examples. I mean, Jim has attempted to govern by press conference. And where you talk about power, where you talk about power plays, I mean, I assume that the professor is referring to the charter change to go and to move the city attorney from the. I mean, am I correct on this? Is that your primary example as far as a power play?
That certainly would be one, but
okay. And I mean, and in that case, I mean, what brought that about? I'll be honest with you. I never said this publicly before, but when it happened, I mean, I told Debbie and Terry, I thought it was politically the stupidest thing that I've ever seen in my life, and yet they felt they had no choice, because when the mayor refuses the council access to the city attorney, they're going, what choice do we have?
Let me ask you something, because if one is responding simply to negativity, right, it would seem to me that not only Campbell would be held to account, as you say, but that the Jim Ireton, right, that there would be. But on the other,
what did I preface everything with?
But that didn't happen.
No, it didn't, because in some cases, and I've heard Joe admit to this on election night, that there were voters who went and looked at it as a lesser of two evils. But again, when you look at the turnout numbers, you look at the results and you look at the turnout numbers. And again, I don't want to take anything away from Jim's victory or Jake's. Cheney's a slightly different thing. That's pretty much business as usual. But I don't want to take anything away from their victory, because, again, what was clear is that there is a huge amount of either apathy or voter turnoff in the city when it comes to municipal elections. And Jim and Jake ran a very successful turnout operation. They ran a phone bank out of, and I think it was Delmarva Labor Council's office in the Cannon Building. And I certainly don't begrudge, and I don't begrudge that. That's what you're supposed to do in a campaign. They had the resources available to do it. The Democrat Party and DLC and other groups, were behind them on this. And again, and there's nothing illegal about it, and I don't see anything wrong with it. It's politics.
Michael, what about this issue about negativity? The fact that was one of the questions I had going into the general election out of the primary was, is this going to be an anti-incumbent feeling? Because we didn't really have a face-off in terms of the mayor's election. And yet here, was it just simply that, and my thing I saw, I don't know whether it was Jay's blog, that it simply did not have the right candidate to compete with Jim Ireton. You think that's one of the things that might have happened here?
Sure, yes. Now, I think that Jim Ireton had to heave a sigh of relief, actually, with only Joe Albaro as the opposition, because, again, the electorate, you do not see an excited electorate. It's not a mobilized electorate. It's a disengaged electorate to a large extent, it seems to me. And Mayor Ireton was able to do was basically to mobilize the same set of voters. I mean, I don't know this for a fact, but it would make good sense. The same set of voters that got him elected in the first place to get him reelected this time around. And those particular voters were not disengaged or alienated from Mr. Ireton, so they were willing to reelect him. And as I say, I still think, though, that so I would still lump Albaro with Campbell in terms of the perception. Now, whether the perception has good reason or not, the broad perception seems to me was these are two negative politicians, the incumbent councilwoman Campbell and the would-be mayor Albaro, that really we no longer want that kind of thing in our politics. Going forward, it seems to me that Ireton now has the challenge, though, to recognize that kind of disengagement and to try to mobilize people behind certain initiatives. And I would agree that for example, the tiff that the mayor has had with local media seems to me is counterproductive, that instead of aligning up having that tiff, he should open up and sort of really try to engage local media with an effort to mobilize the city's citizens behind new initiatives. I mean, that's what is necessary moving forward, not only for policy policy answers to our problems, but for a healthier public arena, a healthier politics, which we desperately need, seems to me.
I want to get before we get to the new coalition. I want to look at the old one, because it seems that it's actually very complicated. Because I mean, obviously you had Joe Albaro, who certainly supported Debbie Campbell. There was a sense of cohesion at one point. Jim Ireton was all involved, and as I kind of look down below and start looking at some of the issues. For example, when I talked to Joe Albaro about the 4-2 rental restrictions, he didn't like them. That was something that Debbie Campbell really was passionate about. Certainly, I remember that. There was, when I talked to, say, Albaro about how do you get business in, he talked about incentives. Council member Campbell seemed to be very reluctant about incentives. So there seems to be some cross purpose. And then you get on top of that, when you start to move Ireton into this little puzzle. For example, he had his rental legislation with tenants' rights, which they did pass, but also a measure that would decide whether or not the property was properly zoned for rentals, three strikes. That seemed to then bog down very slowly, even though I know that Debbie Campbell, who told me, she was involved at least in helping draw up some of this legislation. That seemed then just to simply stall out. So when I look at this puzzle, I am puzzled by how these pieces did not really seem to fit together. What's your assessment,
Gene? Well,
I mean, am I wrong about this? Or?
Well, in some of the details, yes.
Go ahead.
You know, example, tenant bill of rights was a council initiative that wasn't Jimmy. But it brings up an excellent but that piece of legislation by itself brings up an excellent point. It ties in with what Professor Loft was talking about, which is the perception of negativity. And I would go and say that it's with some people it may be a perception of negativity, or it may be a perception of bore me to death, or go and or bogging or things just bogged down. If I remember correctly, it took something like 9 months to go and get that piece of legislation passed. Now, I don't know if you two have ever read the Tenants' Bill of Rights legislation. Okay, It's not very long. It says that – and it says that you have to go – that this form has to be attached to a lease to all leases in the future. And it says that, you know, you've got certain rights. And it has web links. I mean, that's really basically it. And it took 9 months.
Why is that? I mean, they all seem to be on board. And I can remember being at a community meeting.
They weren't all on board. And that's the problem. Mm. Because we're talking about the old coalition, right, versus the new, yeah, coalition. Laura Mitchell, Shaney Shields were obstructive as all get out.
Well, they opposed it, right. But you have a majority who
I understand
seem.
That. Yes. And I think – I will go to my grave believing this, that one of the things that harmed Debbie in this election and could potentially harm Terry Cohen and Tim Spies in the next election is the fact that in an attempt to appear in an attempt to look nice, in an attempt to accommodate the minority, they allow themselves to be played like $2 fiddles. Things got bogged down. Things took forever. Because you're a smart guy, and you go and pay attention to this stuff. And what you're, hey, they're in the majority, right? They should have steamrolled them. And that sounds harsh, but I mean, but look, you give
that's
the
right,
parties,
exactly.
You give the parties, the opposition, an opportunity to go and make their case, and then vote on it. That's it. And why they allowed these things to drag on forever. And another problem that has come back to haunt them, and it's tied directly into this, is even though, you know, Debbie, Terry, Tim, they're all friends of mine, and I think the world of them, but this particularly applies to Mrs. Cohen and Mrs. Campbell, was the fact that this obsession with dotting I's and crossing T's. And I understand and I understand why they did that, because they've been burned in the past, particularly under the previous city attorney. But at the same time, you know, do your best to get it right and move on.
Let me ask you this. Now, I should also note, by the way, I remember when Tim Spies was running for election, he, as I recall, was not crazy about certain elements of the proposed concept, anyway, the legislation, in terms of particularly rental zoning. But then the mayor also seemed to be at odds then with his old allies over things like the BRICS or things like Lenders of the Week. And so it things that I would have thought would have been resolved long before they all got into office. And yet there seemed to be this breakup, this fissure between what Jim's vision was and what their vision was.
Well, the BRICS wasn't an issue. Until after, I mean, it wasn't an issue when they ran 4 years ago. It wasn't something to come up for discussion. But then he decided he wanted to do it. The council majority, right, again, where they got hurt was this attempt to go and accommodate the minority, accommodate the mayor, give them a full hearing instead of just going and moving forward, and that's a problem.
Although in the case of like the BRICS, for example, it was a clear majority on the council said nope, we don't want to do this, which is clearly at odds with the kind of vision that Ireton had. I mean, in terms of city activity and these pieces of real estate they own and so on. I mean, there seems to be a philosophical difference.
To be honest, I mean, and this is speculation. I don't have any I don't have any evidence for this, but it just seems to me that particularly in the case of the BRICS, this was an issue for Jimmy because he didn't like to be told no. He kind of went along with it. I mean, remember, the BRICS was more than anyone, it was Louise Smith's project. And then he wanted to go and move forward with it. He was being told no. Jimmy doesn't like to be told no. And I think that's why it became such an issue. And in fact, that was where I referenced earlier about him standing on a soapbox and calling elected officials racist. That had to do with the BRICS.
As I talked to Mayor Ireton, I mean, he seemed very passionate about that and about actually a number of those other issues. Let me turn to you, Michael, for a moment and ask you what you make of this how this coalition, just that piece of it, there's sort of this divorce, and I think that was actually the term that some people used at towards the end between Ireton on the one hand and this council majority. I mean, what do you make of that, especially having looked at, you know, we've had this long stretch, particularly in the late 1990s, you know, Barry Tillman was elected, and there were a number of council people who were elected with her support, and then the whole thing began to collapse on the council. We've seen this sort of routine before. What do you think happened between this council majority, which seemed to be all on the same page, and the fact that it came apart?
I wouldn't claim to have great insight in terms of the personalities here, but certainly what appears is that the policy agreements that one saw initially, right, should have been able to sustain both the council and the mayor moving forward. Whatever compromises could have been compromises to be reached without the personality and power, the egos of council members, it seems to me, transcend the policy questions. So that again, we're not talking about rocket science at city politics. A lot of these issues, seems to me, it can be addressed with compromises, and that the divisions that didn't seem to be particularly policy oriented, but more ego oriented, and perhaps claiming my project needs to move forward or I must get this exactly right when that was unnecessary.
How do you compare this day, for instance, to what seemed to be a breakup, as it were? When, I mean, Barry Tillman came in with this whole idea about new government, and yet ultimately there were people who she supported who seemed to at least to turn against her. Is there a comparison between what's happened here and back then?
Absolutely. I think this is, again, and this has been a chronic political problem in Salisbury politics, that we don't have – we don't have parties. We need political parties. The function of political parties is this is our policy line, and you subordinate your egos. You subordinate your idiosyncratic differences to – a policy agenda, right? And as you were suggesting, you know, if you have a 3-2 majority, is that really based on policy or is it based on friendships? If it's based on friendships, then that's not a good basis or foundation to build good politics.
Let me, by the way, before we get to the new coalition, just briefly wanted to talk about Albaro, because in interviewing Joe Albaro, he seemed to be very much from the business community. When I asked him about incentives, for instance, to attract business in downtown, he talked about business incentives. That seemed to be at odds with, say, a vision that, for instance, that Councilwoman Campbell had, that she was very reluctant. And it would seem as if both of them had been elected, there would have been another division. What did you read Joe that
yes
way?
And,
how did you?
Yes and no. It's, you know, Debbie Campbell was on record as saying she didn't oppose incentives. She opposed subsidy.
Right.
All right. Now.
And I guess we're going to ask what the difference is, right?
Exactly. Exactly. And therein lies the problem. However, from what I gathered from Joe, I mean, I don't believe that, you know, there was no evidence that he was advocating the millions of dollars of subsidy that was handed out during the Dream Team era. I mean, there was in excess of $10 million that was borrowed and handed over to developers in the form of developer reimbursements and other, you know, TIFs and other subsidies. So that's, you know, that, you know, would it have been an issue? It might have been. But Professor Laughlin brought something up just a minute ago. I mean, it ties perfectly into this, where, you know, while I disagree with you that it might have been that these may have been candidates based on friendships rather than policy, but you made the state or a comment that nobody's willing to sit down and negotiate. And you're absolutely right on this. And you know, and of course Jimmy will go and say that, oh, that was their fault, and the council will say that was his fault. But the thing is, that part's over. But there was an unwillingness to sit down. One of the successes, and I mean, and look, there was no deception with this. I mean, I was a huge opponent of Barry Parsons Tillman, and yet. Her with the Dream Team Council, that even though, while I disagreed with many of their policies, they were successful in moving things forward because And I've had conversations with some of those council members, you know, off the record, who would say, yeah, you know, I'd go visit Barry in her office, and I'd say, hey, look, Barry, I got a problem with this. You know, I could support you here, here, and here, but I can't support this. Well, how can we work it out? That wasn't for whatever reason, you know, whether it's intransigence on the part of Jimmy, or pridefulness, or a belief that, or a belief that it's somehow morally dishonest to go and negotiate. I mean, that's what politics is, and that's why we're having the problems not just that we're having today, not just in Salisbury, but in our federal government as well.
Let me just briefly turn to the future, and we'll be talking more about the future. What are we to make of this this new majority with Jake Day coming on? Because it still seems to me that Jim Ireton has certain priorities, such as the rental legislation, which clearly is opposed by somebody, say, such as Shaney Shields, for example. Do you think we're going to get this kind – Mike, what do you think? Are we going to get some fissures here again? Because, I mean, Jim Ireton comes out with a particular vision, not necessarily having been shared by say, somebody like Shaney.
Well,
is it going to be deja vu all over again? Is that
the opportunity beckons, right? So that if Mayor Ireton can look back on his first 4 years and say, maybe I was too unwilling to negotiate. Perhaps now I have a new opportunity. I mean, he does have a really new opportunity, because clearly there is going to be a shift in who the council president is going to be, and at the very least a 3-2 majority could emerge if he understands that he needs to have a council to move things forward. So again, whether personalities change, however, I mean, the election may not necessarily change Jim's personality. So that's going to be an important part of what goes forward.
Let me just intern quickly to you. We've got about a minute left. GA, one of the indications from Jim on election night was he said that he had evolved when it comes to being more business friendly, and that you don't have to trade off neighborhoods for business. There were a number of business folks obviously supported Jake Day and seemingly Ireton. What do you think that means? Are we going to see a more friendly, business friendly, or what the business community
we'll
wants
see,
to say?
I mean, we'll see. I think the next few months are going to be very telling and very interesting, because Jim Ireton has for 2 years tried to implement a tax increase. The council stopped him. I'm quite confident he'll try to do the same thing again. Jake Day is on record as saying that he doesn't support a tax increase, and then on top of everything else, you've got the proposed storm water authority, which is just another tax, but you know, different shade lipstick on the pig, and they're gonna now Jake Day is not on record as opposed to that. He says, because you know, we have to do it, but that's going to be very telling to see how that works out, because with the stormwater authority, depending on the size of the property tax increase, that could be perceived as very business friendly. Also, but it's the lockout ordinance that really has people.
Yeah, I know, the fire alarms. We're going to have to hold it right there. We've been talking with G.A. Harrison, who supported both Joel Barrow and Debbie Campbell. He's a local blogger, as well as Salisbury University Professor Michael Laughlin, who was a supporter of Mayor Barry Tillman. You've been listening to Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush, and thanks for listening. If it's springtime, it must be time again for Reed Green Festival on the campus of Salisbury University. Welcome to a special edition of Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. And the Children's Literature Festival focuses on books that promote environmental stewardship with its Green Earth Book Awards. And its keynote speakers, Olivia Buller. She is 13 years old and has won a number of awards, as well as creating 500 illustrations help raise money for wildlife recovery efforts. Also offered and illustrated a book, Olivia's Birds, Saving the Gulf. And she is in our studio, along with Ernie Bond. He is a Salisbury University professor and one of the organizers of the Children's Literature Festival. We also have Elliot Schiffer. He is author of Endangered, as well as Andre Magnuson, who is author of Dreamland. Welcome to you all. First of all, I want to go to you, Ernie, and tell us a little bit about this year's festival, and what do you see as the highlights here in terms of what you've got here? I mean, obviously, you've got Olivia here.
Yeah, absolutely. There's so many highlights. We have 10 amazing authors and illustrators in the Salisbury area for the festival this year. This is the 9th year that we've collaborated with the Nature Generation, which is the foundation that brings the Green Earth Book Awards to campus. And there's so many things happening. There's 20 talks in local schools. So over 1,000 kids are going to get to meet with the authors and illustrators who are in town. And we have a National Book Award winner, a National Book Award finalist. We have just about every award you can imagine in children's literature is represented at the festival this year. So it should be pretty amazing. The Saturday conference is sold out. We've filled up all the spaces, though if somebody's desperate to come and would like to see the authors, we can probably squeeze them in. We have several speakers on campus and then speakers all over, as far away as Kent Island. So it's widespread. It's going to impact the Eastern Shore in some interesting ways, and we're very excited about it.
We wanted to now turn to Olivia. Are you 13?
Yes, I am.
Okay. And you got sort of into this interesting thing because you got interested in the oil spill and in birds. Tell me a little bit about how that came about.
Well, I've always loved birds ever since I was little. And my dad, my grandparents, mm-hmm. grew up along the Gulf Coast, and they seen tons of birds. And I just fell in love with them. So when I heard about the oil spill, I knew the birds. So it really hit my heart. And I knew I needed to do something. I couldn't just sit there with my hands tied behind my back.
So how did it develop then that you got this idea that you get maybe perhaps people donate and you could make some drawings, and I understand one drawing class, I think is what somebody had said.
Yeah, I really haven't taken any drawing classes. My mom's an artist, so she's helped me. My dad's an architect, so, you know. My parents, when they saw how upset I was, they said, well, go for it, being the awesome parents that they are, you know. Mm-hmm. They spawned a pretty good child, too. I do say so myself.
So how did you go about getting a hold of the Audubon Society?
I knew the Audubon Field Guide because it's just so famous, and because of John James Audubon, I knew his story, and I use his field guide all the time, so I knew I wanted to use the Audubon Society, because I know it was going to something good. So I said when people donated, they could email my mom with their receipt, and they get a painting, and I would do up to 500 drawings, and I didn't expect that I was going to do 500. It was just, my dad said, well, if you have trouble, just say 500. I'm like, okay, because I'm 10 at the time. I said I was 11, but I was like, anyway, that doesn't matter.
And so how was it trying to do these drawings?
Well, it was a lot of time management. I can say that my homework also required attention because I don't want to be yelled at by Mrs. Fazio. But I had to learn what my priorities, when to goof off, when to play with my younger brother, when to do a painting. And the drawings were called for in 3 weeks. So I had to spend my summer 3 months basically doing them.
So what was it like actually doing them? I mean, and how did you decide which ones you would do? And what was that process like?
Well, after a while, I kind of got in a groove of how I was going to do them. I discovered the light box where you could trace birds that you previously drew, and which was one of my saviors. I basically did 250 species, different species, and I wanted to mix it up so I had fun doing it. I wanted to really have fun in it because I love drawing. I didn't want it to be a pain. So I took it one drawing at a time.
And you gave them color and so on. And what? How was that? How did you do that?
I used ebony pencil, just did an outline, and I shaded a little bit. And then I went over with just watercolors, you know, liquid watercolor, and then they were done. And I've lately been taking more time doing it and getting a little more tight and more realistic, I think. But when I was on Larry King, I did 9 paintings in 2 hours, so I'm pretty efficient. Somebody timed me once. I forget what news station, but it was I did a painting in 7 minutes.
That's remarkable.
Thank you.
That's very fast. So, as I understand it, you may want to be an ornithologist. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about it. I'm thinking about maybe going to Cornell or one of the great schools for ornithology. But I also want to study art. Because, you know, I find that it's not really work for me. I enjoy doing it, and I really like surrealism, and I really want to get into the art world.
Mm. So you want to maybe do a little bit of both? Or
mm-hmm.
And then you sort of have this book, as it were, Olivia's Birds. Tell me, how did that, is this just a compilation here, or what?
It was actually a crazy story. Some girl, a daughter of a literary agent, said, "Mom, you should do a book on this." And they called us up, and we got in contact with Sterling Publishing, and bam, they just asked me, "Do you want to do a book?" And I'm like, "Oh, yeah." So this book came into, you know, the world.
Into being, as it were. Now I also that you were sort of inspired by James Audubon himself, the French-American who painted lots of birds, mm-hmm. obviously out of North America. What did you know about him, and how did he inspire you?
I knew that he had come here when he was 18 and that he loved the Phoebes. And he was the first real ornithologist to ban birds and let them roam and check on them when he got older. And he really saw the world when it was more pristine. And he knew about the ivory-billed woodpeckers and the passenger pigeons. And he saw the world when it was at its fullest. But he documented it, so it meant a lot to ornithology. In the history of it, so I think he's someone to look up to.
So when you saw the destruction from the oil spill, and we could see, matter of fact, I remember seeing some of the birds even on television. What was that like, seeing those birds, that particularly that you had grown up with, in terms of visiting and so on? I mean,
it was really horrible. I didn't really watch the news. You know, I'm 13.
Right.
And why would I watch the news except for a social studies assignment? But but when I was on TV, because of everything, I tried to not watch it or not, because it really just brought a great sadness to me, you know, seeing birds dying. I mean, I know that over 700 mm-hmm. birds died, 7,000, something like that, in the sevens.
Right.
But it's really horrible, the disaster, and I really didn't want to take it to heart. Too much.
Do you think that you'll try to become or be active in the future in terms of trying to preserve wildlife like this? Or is this a one-time thing for you?
No, I want to do this for my whole life. My dad's a renewable energy architect where he does zero energy buildings. And, you know, he told me the possibilities for our country in these fields. And, you know, I went and spoke and I lobbied for clean energy. I mean, it's like breathing for me. I want to help, so I do whatever I can.
So what are the other kids that you know, that your age, what do they think about all this?
I'm not very popular at school.
No? Why not?
No, they don't know how awesome I am.
Oh, I see.
I'm too cool for them. But I think that they're jealous. They don't get me. They don't get the whole do it for other people thing. Mm-hmm. I have one best friend who really doesn't care whatever I do. He supports me, mm-hmm. and he's really awesome. But, you know, he loves Pokemon, and he's kind of flunky. So he's not one to judge.
He's not one to judge. And I understand finally that apparently your family's got into the bird watching. That you seem, I mean, you mm-hmm. sort of led the way here in terms
yeah.
of.
Yeah. But my brother, he's charismatic. I mean, he's a World War II buff. Say okay. B-14 bomber, and you'll sit there for 2 hours. But my whole family has always embraced the idea of being themselves, and I really got my family into birds But my parents always loved the environment. And my brother is following my footsteps. He raised $800 for a Puffin project in Maine. You know, he's really awesome. And my family's really cool.
And what are your favorite birds?
I can't say that. It will hurt the birds' feelings.
I read that it was the American kestrel and blue jay, but...
Well, that was probably older. Now that I've thought about it, it's very offensive. The birds listening on the radio, I apologize. Oh. I'm not being choosy.
Yeah, okay, you've evolved, I guess.
I've seen that it may hurt others' feelings to say things that is very partial.
Okay, and...
Must not be racist.
All right, that's fine. I want to move on. Another author is Elliot Sheffer. He's the author of Endangered, which is, I guess it's sort of a novel, as it were, a story about the bonobos. It's they're like chimpanzees, I guess, as it were, although a bit different.
Yep.
And it takes place in the Democratic Republic of Congo, the story itself just outside of Kinshasa. Set the story up for us a little with, I guess, this girl named Sophie.
Sure. Endangered is a novel about a 13-year-old girl who's half American, half Congolese, and she spends the summers with her mother in Congo and her school years with her father in Florida. And so one day when she's visiting her mother, she sees alongside the side of a road a man with an orphan ape, a baby orphan ape that he's trying to sell. The average income in DRC is $12 a month, and an infant bonobo can get $25 on a black market, or if it's smuggled out, $1,500. So there's actually a big trade in them coming out of Congo. And so she ends up buying the ape, not realizing that by doing that, she's actually funding the trade in endangered animals within the country. And so her mother is very angry, but for this baby ape to survive, it has to attach with a maternal figure. So Sophie ends up, for the summer, being a surrogate mother for this bonobo. And then Congo falls into war while she's there, and she has to make her way across the country at war to find her mother, who's on the other side of the country, while caring for this ape, who's, they're 98.7% of the same DNA as people. So it's almost like having a child and not a pet. So it's this unique bond that they form as they try to survive together.
Now, what's the situation with them? Because I know, as I was reading, that they don't seem to exist outside of the Congo area. And the population estimate I saw was something between, say, 29,000 and 50,000, which seems very small, actually. What's the situation? Are they, and I guess they are endangered, I guess.
Yes, they're very endangered. They're the least populous of the four great ape species. So you have the chimpanzees, gorillas, and orangutans, and most people think that's where it ends.
Mm-hmm.
And bonobos used to be called pygmy chimpanzees. They were thought to be the subspecies of chimp. But they're actually quite a different animal. And when anthropologists used to look at what human origins were, they went to the chimp because they thought that was our only close relative. But chimps, you know, have a lot of a really dark side to their nature. Being a female chimp means being, by our standards, abused daily. Chimps have a tendency to go to war against each other and kill just to stake out territory. But bonobos have none of those issues. There's no recorded violence among bonobos. Being an infant bonobo means living in a largely harmonious society. And the reason is that they're matriarchal, that they have really strong social connections between the females. And in a country like Congo, where so much of the violence is directed against women, it seemed a really important paradox or a contrast that, you know, this great emblem for the best sides of our biological heritage of what human nature means lives only in the country with the worst human conflict since World War II.
So is the conflict itself, you talk about how at one point Sophie and the bonobo, that they're sort of safe in this sort of electrified safe area, but then the electricity goes out and the war sort of seeps in. Tell me a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, the thing that got me interested in writing a novel was that contrast between these peaceful bonobos and a country at war. But Sophie and Otto, during that summer when she's attaching to him and becoming his mother and giving him a will to survive after his family was killed, it's spent in this bonobo sanctuary. So they're behind this. And I stayed in DRC doing research for the book at a sanctuary for bonobos, and you see these fences. It looks like something out of Jurassic Park. You know, it's 10,000 volts, really, really tall, 40 feet tall, because the adult bonobos are really aggressive, so you don't want to be with them. And so the premise of the book, what made it a novel and not a piece of nonfiction, was when I realized that if the country fell into war and you wanted to survive and you were at one of these sanctuaries, the safest place to be would be on the other side of that fence. So if soldiers came, they couldn't cross that 10,000-volt fence. So Sophie ends up living with the Bonobo Society in the sanctuary with the adults in order to survive when soldiers come to the sanctuary.
What was that in your novel? What was that experience like for her, and how was it different than, say, just living with, say, regular people, as it were? I mean, what was it, and how did you approach that?
Yeah, well, people often ask why I had a female main character, and also why she was 14. Why is this a teenager and not an adult? And I think, you know, I couldn't have survived Sophie's journey. The bonobos tend to be really fearful and aggressive towards human males. They know the difference very easily. But human females, they almost see as just weird naked bonobos. Like, they just lost their hair, and they're acceptable. And so you can see, you know, at the sanctuary, there's four local Congolese women who work as surrogate mothers. And it's amazing to see these hulking, really strong bonobos. Adult bonobos are three times as strong as a human adult. Just melt when their surrogate mother came nearby, because they used to be babies on that woman's lap, and they came to see this human person as a mother. And so even when they become really strong adults, all they want to do is like hold hands with their mom. And so for Sophie, becoming part of that culture, at first she is, you know, she's far weaker than the bonobos. They're aggressive towards her because she's an outsider. But once she survives the first few weeks, you know, she has strategies and intelligence that is beyond bonobos. So in some ways, she saves Otto by being his mother, but he also saves her. And so it's not that anyone is protecting any one other species, that it becomes a sort of a mix and a shared responsibility for survival.
What kind of interaction then is there between her and the bonobos and Otto, which is the one that she buys?
One of the things I had Endangered plotted out in broad strokes before I went to the sanctuary, and then a lot of the details changed once I was there and I was with the actual bonobos. I imagined it would be like holding a stuffed animal, having one of these youngsters on your lap. But when it actually happened, they're so dense. It feels like you have a ball of wire that you're holding. And the reason is they have much less body fat than people. That's why they can't swim. They're really, really, really muscular. But then I went into the nursery, and I was immediately swarmed by orphan bonobos who just wanted to play. So they were on top of my head. They were playing King of the Mountain. They were having a grand time. And one of them, I had bonobos on my face, literally, so I couldn't see my feet. But I could feel one of the young bonobos pulling at my shoe. And someone was videotaping it, and only when I watched the video hours later did I see this bonobo had untied my shoe, and then instead of pulling off the shoe and running away with it, the bonobo had actually tried to retie it. I have the video. It's up on my website. It's amazing to see. Like, he actually makes the two loops, looks at the other shoe, and tries to make it happen. He doesn't actually succeed,
right?
But he made like a very loose knot. But I was so impressed that it's not just an example of intelligence, but also this impulse to sort of create and make something that this bonobo was doing. So that became part of the book, because when Sophie is traveling across this country at war, she's captured at one point by a soldier, and it's by this orphan bonobo tying Sophie's shoe. She pretends that it's from her magic, and that that impresses the soldier enough that she survives the night. So it ends up, you know, that's where the responsibility, it's not that, you know, it's just always humans saving animals, that there's a shared responsibility.
So now you wrote this for a younger audience. What kind of, I mean, reception obviously you got, but how do you, what do you want to communicate to those people who are young adults who are reading your book?
I think I'm trying to show the intense similarity that there is in between humans and bonobos, but I felt paralyzed when I was beginning the book, because when there's so much human suffering in a country like Congo, it seemed to me almost immoral to worry about animals at the same time. That the greater human need made moot this issue of, like, oh, the bonobos are being hunted as well. But once I was there, and you see that the same power structures that are hurting families and especially women in eastern Congo are the exact same power structures that are leading to people being so impoverished that the old taboos against eating great apes are eroding, and they're going into the jungle and shooting them. So I think, you know, there's a sense that if there's a large suffering out there, I can't worry about a smaller one, and that's just paralysis, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I think, in some ways, Sophie makes it makes it through that conundrum by the end of the book, and the emotional reality of this animal that is depending on her allows her to open up and see the human suffering in Congo in a light in which she can see that they're both related, and that you don't have to ignore one suffering in order to help another one.
Yeah, another completely different sort of book or work is The Dreamland, a self-help manual for a frightened nation, which is written by Andre Magnusson. And it's about Iceland and the effort, as I understand it, to build out some of the country's rivers in order to produce energy for aluminum factories, but that appears to have an impact. Tell me a little bit about, give me sort of some background as to how this effort to utilize these great waterfalls and this great water, how that came about and what kind of impact is it having on the environment there?
Yeah, that is that's kind of my other project. I have I'm here for The Story of the Blue Planet, which
right.
is my children's book, but Dreamland, but that also is kind of inspired by these issues. So Iceland is an unspoiled place in most, and we have all these things that are called nature, running waterfalls and hot springs and all these things, but according to engineers and sometimes the market, this is called still unexploited energy. But the problem is that Iceland is very scarcely populated. We're only 300,000, so we could never have the demand of domestic use to destroy all our waterfalls and our geothermal areas, but there's something called aluminum in the world, and I don't know if people know about it when they're buying a can or throwing away something, that one aluminum smelter uses energy like 1 million people. So we're 300,000 in Iceland, and suddenly we had this thing where our government had promised energy for 3 or 4 aluminum smelters, which equaled that we had actually become 4 million in Iceland overnight. And this was promising to destroy most of our most beautiful geothermal areas and most of our most beautiful rivers. So I am not a specialist in any of these fields. I'm not an environmental... I'm not a biologist. I'm not an engineer. I didn't know anything, but I felt something was deeply wrong. So with a background in fantasy, children's books, even science fiction and poetry, I started writing about reality, so real issues, and allowing myself to ask stupid questions. So is that reality when to live off somebody's need to drink aluminum from a can that he's just throwing away? Because like in America, about 1 million tons of aluminum is thrown away annually, and that equals it's like 4 times the commercial air fleet in the United States is thrown away, unrecycled annually. So when we destroy natural habitat of birds, seals, rivers, fish in Iceland to answer that demand, mm-hmm. even though it's clean energy, you know, could you say that is reality to do that? Is that something, but according to all economics, this is economic growth, these are jobs, this is good for the economy, this is growth. So there's something deeply wrong in our approach to all these issues. We're on this kind of vicious cycle of damage and destruction, while there's so much that we could do to fix, but it's like we postpone it, like in Iceland, when we just give in to the system.
Because, yeah, there seems to be this internal conflict that you point to between what we consider to be economic growth and jobs and so on the one hand. On the other hand, sometimes we don't really appreciate the fact what kind of impact that would have.
Yeah, so I went through a journey of looking at the chain of destruction because Jamaica has been gnawed up for mm-hmm. the bauxite.
Right.
And of course, it's a limited resource, so they're just gnawing into more valuable areas every year. But the people of Jamaica are addicted to being gnawing up their land, because if they stop, that means their economy will stagnate and jobs will be lost. But eventually they will have to stop because they'll finish the resource. But then they will have destroyed their island. So there's so many places on Earth that are addicted in this way to being destroying their nature, and they can't get out of it. So that's why most of my book is kind of about ideas and creativity and asking questions, why are we stuck in things like this? But when we meet a natural obstacle, we often overstep it and just find something else to do or new ways of making things. But while we can postpone doing it, we postpone it into the longest. So I use things like a military base that we had in Iceland, and the Cold War was over. They wanted to close down the base, but we didn't want to close down the base. So they asked us, but who's your enemy? And they said, 2,000 jobs at stake. So they said, there's hope in the future. We might have enemies then. You know? So these absurd things that come up of how we stick to reality and lose our imagination.
Didn't want to leave it before talking about the Blue Planet. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, the story of the Blue Planet is about a blue planet in space. There are only children living on that planet. It's a very normal planet with the sun and the moon circling every day. And once a year, the butterflies wake up and they fly one ring around the planet. And that's kind of the most beautiful day. And it's only habitated by children. So they're just very happy and just do whatever they want. When they're hungry, they can catch food or swim in the ocean or jump from the trees. But then this space monster arrives, but it's not a space monster. It's Jolly Good Day. He's the first cool guy that lands on the planet. And he's a traveling space vacuum cleaner salesman, and he doesn't understand how the children can live this boring life on the planet. And he asks them if they don't want to fly. And of course they want to fly. So he sucks the dust off the butterfly's wings, and then they can fly while the sun shines. But then they want to fly during the night too. So he takes a big hammer and a nail and he fixes the sun in the sky so they can fly endlessly. But then two children are swept by the wind and they land on the other side of the planet that is completely dark. And it's some kind of a fairy tale chapter book adventure.
And the children that read this book, what are you hoping that they get out of this? I mean, and understanding, particularly in relationship, obviously we were talking just a moment ago, a very, very serious and sophisticated sort of discussion, but it seems to me these two are essentially related.
Yeah, it's a trilogy. One of them is a children's book, the other is a sci-fi novel, and the third is nonfiction. Mm-hmm. So you can follow this trilogy as you grow up. The Blue Planet has been published now in almost 30 languages, and it's a play opening now in Toronto in just 5 days. But the story is, I was trying to create like contemporary mythology. I've always loved like Nordic mythology, when somebody can, a wolf can swallow the sun, or you can play with the big forces, so I was wondering, all this mythology was made before we knew that we were living on a planet. You know, most of this mythology happens in some kind of a disc world or something, but we're not kind of prepared of living on a planet. So I thought, what would happen if I would try to make like contemporary mythology with these elements and kind of from the things that I love most of folklore and other children's books, and try to understand, why is it so hard to live on a planet? You know, was a planet a good idea in the first place to live on? Should we live on a... Because the horizon is so narrow, and you don't know what's happening on the other side.
We've been speaking with Andre Magnusson. He is author of The Blue Planet, as well as Dreamland. Also, Elliot Sheffer. He's author of Endangered, which is a book about the bonobos, as well, of course, as Olivia Bowler, who is author of Olivia's Birds, Saving the Gulf. And we've also, of course, had on Ernie Bond. He's a Salisbury University professor and one of the organizers, by the way, of this year, as always, the Children's Literature Festival. You've been listening to Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush, and thanks for listening.
Delmarva Today is a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Don Rush is the host. Cora Mitchell is our volunteer producer. Chris Rank is the executive producer and audio engineer. You can listen to this program again on our website, delmarvapublicradio.net. You can also view our program on PAC-14 television and on demand. Visit PAC-14.org for full details and schedules.